From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, John Lithgow talks about his latest film, Beatrice at Dinner, and Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Syeda Garrett discusses the inspiration behind her new song. It's called Ghetto. But first, fired FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee raised more questions about the Trump administration's connections to Russia and about the relationships within the White House than it perhaps answered. President Trump's supporters feel vindicated by Comey's testimony, while Trump's opponents are convinced that the White House still has something to hide. Our first guest, Barbara Boxer, just retired from the U.S. Senate earlier this year after representing California as a lawmaker for 3 decades. She's also the author of the text, The Art of Tough, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life, which is now out in paperback. She joins us now to discuss the Comey hearings and more. Senator Boxer, good to have you back on this program.
I'm so happy to be with you.
Before I jump into what you're doing and your thoughts about what's happening in the world, let me start with the person who took your seat in the Senate from California. Now the only African-American, well, Cory Booker is there, of course.
Yes.
From New Jersey.
Yes.
And Tim Scott is there from South Carolina.
Correct.
But she's the only black woman in
Absolutely.
The United States Senate, Kamala
right.
Harris, and she made some news with some pretty tough questioning. What did you make of that questioning?
I was so proud of her.
Yeah.
You know, she's trying to get to the bottom of a really big problem. What are they hiding in this administration? Where's this whole connection with the election in Russia and Trump's business and, you know, trying to intimidate Comey and others? So she was tough, and they tried to cut her off, and I just want to say, as a woman in politics for so long, unfortunately, that happens to women more than you can imagine. Mm. And she just refused to be intimidated. She stood her ground. And I thought I was proud.
Yeah.
I was proud of her.
I'm not naive in asking this, but why does that happen to women more than we mm-hmm. think it does?
You know, the men that do this, they don't even realize it. In the back of their mind, I just think people who have power resent others who are trying to get some power. And I don't get it, but it happens. It just does. And we saw it with Anita Hill. Mm-hmm. We saw it with Elizabeth Warren when they said, you know, McConnell said, she was quoting Dr. Martin Luther King, and they stopped her. And he said, she persisted mm-hmm. in talking. Well, that's
yeah.
what you do mm-hmm. as a senator. And they do it across the board to women. I had it happen when I was told to sit down when we were trying to get the very first person who was a lesbian into the government in the Bill Clinton days. They took down my words because I quoted from a San Francisco Chronicle editorial in favor of Roberta Aktenberg, who was trying to become the housing secretary. We got her through.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of that, they actually tried to stop me. So it goes on, and I think people are seeing it.
Yep. One more question about the hearing before we move on to some other issues here. And this happens, of course, to men and to women. What's it like being a member of Congress when you are responsible for oversight
mm-hmm.
and you're asking questions like Senator Harris did and others for that matter? There was a litany of a long list of members who asked questions. And they were essentially stonewalled.
Yeah.
As a member of Congress, how do you engage your responsibility for oversight when these persons sit there in front of you and just won't answer your questions?
Well, in my book, The Art of Tough, mm-hmm. I talk about how you have to be tough. You have to hold to your questions. You have to make sure the people watching understand you're being stonewalled, and you never give up. The most frustrating thing is you usually only have 5 to 7 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Tavis. You know, we have a little longer here, so we can go into depth. So a member of Congress that is charged with oversight who's getting stonewalled is really set back. But they have to utilize that time to make their point and to expound on why they think there's a stonewall. And then you can turn it around, but it does take a certain toughness not to just say, okay, I'll take my marbles and go home. You have mm-hmm. to be just as tough as the person answering your questions, or I should say, dodging your questions.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of hearings, let me jump now to the hearings of James Comey. All the fireworks that people were looking forward
yes.
to, I think he delivered on what people were expecting in terms of his shining a light on what happened in those meetings with President Trump. There is increasingly a number of high-profile Americans, Americans of note and authority, those who know the system, who are saying that clearly now there is enough evidence of obstruction of justice. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with those persons?
I would say there certainly are, we certainly have a roadmap toward that, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm not an attorney. It takes a certain kind of a look at this where you have to go to motivation. But the more we see it, it's a very disturbing pattern. So I definitely think that there's some there. Mm-hmm. For example, you're not just talking about firing Comey. You're talking about firing Bahara, Preet Bahara.
Who came out
yes, who
and
said
he believes there is enough evidence of obstruction.
But he felt very uncomfortable because he said it was uncomfortable for him for the president to keep cozying up to him when he has the investigatory power. Mm-hmm. Then you had Sally Yates, who came to the president with open arms and said, I'm really worried about Flynn's contact with Russia. She gets fired. Now Comey gets fired. So to me, this pattern of intimidation adds up to, at the minimum, abuse of power.
There are two attorneys general in Washington and Maryland who have already filed suit, have said they're going to file suit against the president, against the White House. So it seems like even outside of the halls of Congress, this story is gaining some traction, getting legs.
Tavis, I think they are looking at him enriching himself. I think mm-hmm. those were the issues, the D.C. Uh-huh. and the Maryland.
Right.
They're saying he's using his power to enrich himself.
That's correct.
He didn't give up this Trump hotel. He's taking money from all over the place. They got all kinds of gifts, if you will, from China in terms of allowing their patents to go forward. Mm-hmm. I am so glad that these attorneys general are looking at this, because this is the, I've served with five presidents, three Republicans, two Democrats. Since the Ronald Reagan days, I served with him. I never saw a president that I thought was in it for himself, to enrich his family. I am stunned that there's not more talk about looking at the emoluments clause. So I'm really happy to see there are attorneys outside who are going to sue on this point.
Given his background, it's hard to imagine that there weren't millions of fellow citizens who didn't see the same thing that you have just acknowledged now. I mean, we saw this is who this guy has been his entire mm-hmm. life.
Yeah.
And so you say you're happy to see this now. Why didn't the American people see this on Election Day? Why did your girl lose?
Well,
I don't mean girl in the pejorative sense.
No, I know.
Yeah. I don't get called on that.
Why
did Secretary Clinton
lose? I'll tell you. The reason Secretary Clinton lost is going to be volumes of books written about it.
Starting with hers.
I would say yes. And I would say there were a number of factors that went into it, not the least of which is the Electoral College, where mm-hmm. she got 3 million more votes. And I think that's never stated. Mm. And so she won, but she lost. And I think the reason is we Democrats took for granted a lot. You know, when I worked every day of my life for one reason, make life better for people, make sure they had good jobs, make sure they had good minimum wage, make sure they could breathe clean air, make sure that their rights were protected in the workplace. 99% of Democrats do this, but we took it for granted. And he was so outrageous. He insulted more than half the people. And so I think, and I blame myself too, I was out there. I think that we focused too much on him and thought that that was enough. And it was enough for her to win by 3 million, but in the Midwest where they're struggling, she had the plans, but we took it for granted. That's my opinion. Also, the dampening of the turnout in those swing states. I'll tell you right now, every time I ran, my pollster would come and say, Barbara, I've got good news and bad news. What do you want first? Bad news. Mm-hmm. The bad news is if there's a low voter turnout, you're toast. You know, the better news is if it's medium, you got a chance. And the great news is a large turnout, you win in a landslide. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is for Democrats. When our people stay home, Tavis, we lose. And in the Midwest, they had a terrible turnout in those swing states because people were depressed. They thought they were confused on the email thing. They were confused on the WikiLeaks and a lot of the stuff that came out. It was, again, we have to write the book about it. But at the core of it, I think, we just didn't get the message out to the Midwest.
There are
three or four things you've said I want to pick up on. Let me try to remember them. In no particular order, one, when you said that we focus too much on him, part of that we is clearly the media. And my audience knows I've talked about this, you know, ad infinitum, and my disappointment in the way the media covered this campaign, as we always do, like it's a horse race. But it was so abundantly clear that he was getting so much free media, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
What did you make of the way he was regarded, treated by the press then, with the way they now turned on him a few months later?
You know, I find it very hard to blame the media. Ever since Richard Nixon did it, and now Trump is doing it. So I don't go there. It's up to us, those of us who are running, to capture the imagination of everyone, including the media. But you're right. Look, he was so outrageous, and he had so many skeletons, that the media definitely played it. But if I could talk about freedom of the press for a minute, because when people say, what worries you about this president, I talk about this pattern of intimidation, the bullying instead of the governing. But I also think the attack on the media that he has put out there, the press is our enemy. This is so dangerous. And when I speak, and now I speak all over the country, to, especially to young people, to corporate America, what I talk about is this. We're in a very divisive time. We're in an angry time. We can't talk to each other. If you had been a big Trump supporter, you and I would be going at it now. Now it would not be so pleasant.
You don't have that problem.
I understand.
But I take your point, though, yeah.
And you don't have that problem with me.
I'm clear about
so
that.
So, look, we can argue about some small stuff, but on the big side. So I started to think to myself, how can we break through using the art of tough? And one of the rules of the art of tough is don't act out of anger. Try to persuade. Be tough, like Kamala. Be tough, but don't lose it. I did some research, and the great hero of America, one of the greats, George Washington. What did he think about freedom of the press? So I brought one sentence. Would you let me read it?
I certainly will.
I'll tell you why. This is a man who always wrote in the most long-winded fashion, who always was circumspect. Listen to what he said. If freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. This is George Washington. And we have a president who is demeaning the press, who is in a war with the press, who calls it all fake news. We are in a very serious time right now. And I am trying very much in my post-elected life to get out there, and not with anger, but with, I hope, some kind of reasonable approach. Win people over to understand that 2018 is the first time we can check and balance this man. And, you know, regardless of what happens if somebody tries to impeach him, we have to just focus, I think, on 2018.
You said earlier that we agree on most of the big things, and we do, and we could argue about some small things.
Yeah.
In the interest of time, I won't, because there's other things I want to talk to you about. But one could ask, I think, a legitimate question, whether or not the media set themselves up for this, whether or not they had it coming. The point is, with the issue I raised earlier, if they hadn't given this guy so much free press, then maybe he wouldn't have won, and maybe he would not be demeaning us, them, now, the way that he is. But I digress on that point, and I hear the point you're making, and that's a powerful quote from George Washington, so I'll move on. The other issue that you raised I want to come back to is this question of how the Democrats play the hand that they've been dealt. And you've just raised now what opportunity the Democrats have come 2018. Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, gave a big speech to the progressives, many progressives meeting in Chicago, a lot of news media around that. And what he essentially said was that we have to, you know, beat back Donald Trump, take back the White House, take back Congress in 2018. He gave the speech you expected him to give to progressives. The question is whether or not those progressives who are concerned that the party is starting to tilt. I saw a big piece in the New York Times about this, that the party is starting to tilt a little bit to the left, too much to the left for some people, and Democrats are worried that come 2018 they won't be able to take back Congress if the party tilts too far to the left. You're a good progressive. When you hear that kind of conversation, you think what? That you're leaning too far left.
Well, you know, we're a big party.
Yeah.
And so some will lean left, some will lean center, and some will lean right. And if we lose that, we're going to lose. So we can't turn on one another. So we go from left to center to a little bit right of center, just a little bit right of center. And to my view, We have to focus on the big questions. Why are we here? To make life better for people. That's all it's about. Now, one part of the party might go one direction, one might go a little different direction, but we're in it for the right reasons. So if we break up because of it, it would be a tragedy for the country. So we have to be willing, it seems to me, to work together on the things we can agree on, because we agree on 90%. It's just around the edges. That's going to mean, if we're going to turn to our people on the far left mm-hmm. and say, bye-bye, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And if the far left turns to the people who are a little right of center and say, we don't want you, I think it's a big mistake.
But I think you're right, it's a big mistake. But strategically, therein lies the problem. You're the expert here. Therein lies the problem, as you well know, that the folk on the left, many of those persons who supported Bernie Sanders, think that whenever there is a sort of come to Jesus meeting, the meeting is always held in the center. And increasingly held to the right of center, the meeting is never held to the left of center. So they continue to feel left out, disenfranchised, disavowed by the party. Isn't that part of the problem? We saw that in the last election. We saw it at the convention, that the progressives, the left, always feel left out of the conversation and left out of any authority.
Well, I just don't view it that way.
Okay.
I really honestly don't. I mean, we have Bernie Sanders, who's a Democrat. We have Elizabeth Warren, who's a Democrat. We have a number of Democrats who are a little left of center. Mm-hmm. And we have Democrats in the center and a little bit to the right of center. If we hope to win and make life better for people, best we get on with it. Mm-hmm. You're never going to agree with someone 100% of the time. It just doesn't happen. My family doesn't agree with me. We've had a number of arguments over the years. Mom,
yeah.
I can't believe you're not for legalizing marijuana. You know,
yeah.
And we've had all these things go on. And, you know, I just think we can't be stuck in our space. We have to work together. And I'm speaking as someone who is on the liberal wing of the party. But we need to understand that on 99% of everything, we're together.
But would you acknowledge to me, though, would you agree, Senator, that it is a problem, though? And I could point to the speech that Bernie gave. I could point to the fight they had over who was going to lead the party ultimately. Mr. Perez obviously won that fight against Congressman Keith Ellison. But you do admit that the Democrats do have, they've got some work to do.
Yes.
Between now and November 2018.
Yes.
Okay, just ask.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
And all I'm trying to see is a way out of it, which
right.
is that we agree on 98% mm-hmm. of the issues, from the far left probably to the far right of our party,
right.
which is a tad right of center, mm-hmm. if. And we just have to understand, we can't allow that to divide us. We just can't. And I could understand if in a primary, you support one candidate of another, but after it's over, we mm-hmm. have to come together. I think it's absolutely critical. We need to unite, because if we don't, we're going to lose everything.
Yeah.
There's nothing guaranteed. Nothing guaranteed. And you got to fight for it.
Yep. A couple other issues while I have you here. So we are hearing stories that President Trump now wants to sort of tighten the noose, if you will, on Cuba, where President Obama had a different take on that.
Mm-hmm.
Since you were on the Intelligence Committee, would that be a good strategy on his part or a bad strategy?
Bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. We can really have an influence there in the best of ways, our peoples. So it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. What is your sense at this point of his foreign policy agenda, to the extent you think he has a foreign policy agenda?
He likes tyrants.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I never met anyone that likes. He feels so comfortable with them.
Yeah.
And obviously, I don't think it's good for this country.
Yeah.
It's just not. We have to lead people toward, you know, self-governance.
Mm-hmm. On the intelligence front, what most concerns you, again, since you served for so long on that
yeah.
committee, what most concerns you about what his administration is doing or not doing, as it were?
On the intelligence front?
Uh-huh.
Well, what is he doing on the intelligence front? You tell me.
I don't know that we are yet clear on what his agenda is vis-a-vis foreign policy. We know the havoc that he's causing, but is it becoming clear to you what his foreign policy agenda is?
Well, he certainly likes Putin.
Yeah.
I just don't think he has a foreign policy. I don't think he knows where he's going.
That's what I was asking. That's what I'm getting at, whether you think he even has
it. He doesn't know where he's going. And it's just, it's worrisome to me. It's like, where can he sell, you know, America's products? Mm-hmm. Seems to be leading him in that direction.
Yeah. You chose not to run for re-election. You could have. What is it that you think you can do as a private citizen that you couldn't do in Congress?
Well, I'm working to help other people get elected. Mm-hmm. It's very rewarding. We are raising funds to take back the House, do our best to take back the Senate, and we're having events all over the state and some outside the state. And I'm volunteering for my political action committee. And I'm hopeful that we have this opportunity. Even in California, we have a lot of seats we could take back. Mm-hmm. So we're excited about that.
Do you think it's likely that Democrats can take back Congress in 2018, given where he is now?
I think we have a real shot at the House.
Yeah, yeah.
The Senate is a tough map.
Yeah.
But we have a good shot at the House. So we're working very hard. And there's so many women who want to run now.
Yeah.
It's exciting. Thousands.
Yeah.
And they're getting trained, so we have a shot.
Yeah. I appreciate the work that you're doing, and there are others who are doing similar work. But I'm concerned at times when I talk to people on the left who seem to have as their strategy that Donald Trump is ultimately going to implode, that he's going to be impeached. I mean, if he doesn't implode, and we saw him on the campaign trail, we thought he was going to implode every day.
Right.
And the guy won. It was all said and done.
Right.
So to those who think that he's going to implode, they think he's going to be impeached, and they think that that is the best strategy, sort of like sit and wait, he's going to do himself in. What do you say to those persons?
Bad strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
We have to work to make life better for people. We have to bring the issues forward. He's done nothing. He's done nothing. And his budget isn't going to go anywhere. So we need to focus on the House races, on the Senate races. We have to make 2018 a do-or-die year and get ready for 2020. And if he gets impeached, he gets impeached. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't focus on that. You know, we have a lot of work to do. His budget is horrible. It hurts people. His environmental policy is awful. It hurts people. He doesn't seem to really care. So we need to really focus where we can now on this election coming up. And we have a chance, I think, best at taking back the House. And that's what I'm working on with my political action committee. I'm volunteering my time.
Got a minute to go here. Let me close where we began this conversation. We were talking about your service and that of now Kamala Harris, who has your seat. You referenced a moment ago that there are women who want to run. What are the best reasons for women now more than ever to put themselves in the ring to run for office in 2018 and beyond?
Well, for obvious reasons, we, you know, women are equal to men, equally good, equally bad. We should be equally part of every institution, you know, whatever it is, whether it's your business or the business I gave my life to, the business of politics. I think women do bring a certain way of dealing with issues, a certain way of solving problems. So it's an exciting moment. I think if they step forward in this next election, we could make a difference.
Yep. Her name, of course, is Barbara Boxer. She served honorably for more than 30 years in Congress. Her book is now out in paperback. It's called The Art of Tough, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life. Senator Boxer, thank you for your service.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Our next guest, John Lithgow, is a prolific actor. He most recently won awards for his portrayal as British Prime Minister Winston Churchill in the series The Crown, and he just wrapped up the first season of his NBC comedy, Trial and Error. He also stars opposite Salma Hayek in a politically charged, dark comedy called Beatrice at Dinner. Before our conversation, here now a clip from the film.
Well, when I first came to the United States a long time ago...
Did you come legally?
Yes.
Now, how'd that work?
I had family here on my mother's side. My grandmother died and...
They're all citizens or...
Hi, Doug. What, you work for the INS? You're grilling her.
I'm curious. A lot of people come here illegally. I was interested in how she did it.
I'm laughing already. I have not seen you play a guy who I disliked so much. As much as I love you, Mr. Lithgow, I have not seen you play a guy I dislike so much since maybe Ricochet with Denzel. And then you reminded me that your character in Dexter wasn't the nicest guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a full-service entertainer.
Well, you put it to good use in this one, man.
I play the good guys and the bad guys, and most interestingly, the people who fall somewhere in between.
Yeah. What is the joy of playing the bad guys, the mean guys, arrogant guys?
Well, I don't even consider him the bad guy.
Yeah,
when you play this role, you think of him as the righteous one,
mm-hmm.
the one
Fair enough.
He thinks he's right, so you've got to put yourself into that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And so does the writer, Michael White.
Mm-hmm.
Mike White, he just sort of, he loves just the curiosity of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And these are complicated times. I mean, this is a complicated villain.
Yeah.
His name is Doug Strutt. He is a billionaire developer.
Strutt's the right name.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a certain swagger to him.
Yeah.
But he's very comfortable with his own decisions in life. He has no conscience or remorse about anything. Everything is pragmatic with him.
Yeah.
Now, who does this remind you of?
Yeah.
The thing is, it's got, this movie has all the elements of a comedy. It's a mm-hmm. sort of culture clash mm-hmm. story. It's a dinner party among three billionaires and their wives, which by a couple of turns of plot, there is a seventh guest, and this is a poor Mexican immigrant who works as a physical therapist for the lady of the house. This is Salma Hayek.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, bit by bit, it becomes a dialogue, a sort of debate between my character and Salma's.
The social commentary in this thing is searing
mm-hmm.
by the time this thing starts to turn. When you read this on paper, were you immediately turned on by this? I mean, you saw what it was.
Yeah, I was very turned on.
Yeah, yeah.
You're always turned on by dialogue that's that good, that has that much crackle to it. I already knew it was Mike's dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I'd already been in one of his films, a flat-out comedy, mm-hmm. Orange County. And I knew, you know, he's interested in comedy, but he's also interested in much, much broader things.
Mm-hmm.
When he set out to write this, he and Miguel Arteta, the director, who has worked frequently with Mike, they went to Salma and they just presented this as an idea. What if this character, Beatrice, got stuck in a supper party with six wealthy people? What would happen? And they got her excited about the very idea, and 2 weeks later, Mike presented her with a script. He wrote it that quickly.
Mm.
He knows these people. He's very, very interested in tensions between dissimilar people
mm-hmm.
and people who come at situations from a completely different direction. And you just radiated. I mean, I read it and I thought, gosh, I really want to do this. It's also a mordant comedy about what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we go through our lives. One of the problems in our lives is that people from different segments of our society just don't communicate with each other, nor do you ever see entertainment where they communicate with each other and mm-hmm. fight with each other. And that's what Mike set out to do. I was just fascinated by that challenge.
Yeah. When you chin-checked me as nicely and lovingly as you did a few minutes ago by saying to me, Tavis, I don't see him as the bad guy,
uh-huh.
I knew immediately where you were going with that, having seen the project, because you're right. In his mind, he isn't the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
He believes what he believes. He isn't shy about expressing his opinions. And so I took your point when you said that. And yet, the flip side of that is that kind of hubris and that kind of arrogance and that kind of elitism, as one sees in this film, is hard to break through. And it makes me wonder how it is that we, in fact, do that in a world where classism is so entrenched. If the people that we're talking about are like the character that you play, and there really just isn't any there to appeal to.
It's very unsettling. It's a troubling film. It's a challenging film in this way, but I think it's very accurate. There are these social enclaves, certain golf courses, certain social clubs, where people have set up sort of battlements around them. You know, there's just no communication with the rest of society. They are a protected breed. It's all almost anthropological, and yet they're human beings. Mm-hmm. You know, they in doing the film, I was quite surprised and excited by how Miguel, our director, he would direct me to really enjoy himself, genuinely enjoy himself, be very comfortable. He himself was interested in looking around the other side. I mean, of course, particularly liberal film goers already bring all sorts of expectations to this film. They have their point, I should say. Mm-hmm. I'm a liberal Democrat myself. Mm-hmm. I know what the vision and the point of view of this film is, and yet Miguel was intent on turning that on its head, on really challenging people. Doug Strutt says some very frightening things, particularly toward the end. Mm-hmm. He completely accepts, for example, the fact that the environment is decaying and the earth is doomed. He accepts that. What can you do about it? Enjoy yourself. He says these things and it's heart-stopping because he's going at the things that terrify us most. And yet here's a person who's not afraid of that.
Mm-hmm. Because, as you said earlier, John, because he and all his cohorts at the dinner table are, in fact, Homo sapiens, they're human beings as well. I have to believe that every human being has a humanity that is worth respecting and maybe even reveling in. No matter how wrong they may be in their political ideology, they do have a humanity that is worth respecting. How did you connect to the humanity in this character?
Through his humor.
Yeah.
I mean, that had a lot to do with it. Through his own enthusiasms. When he talks about big game hunting in Africa, for example, he talks about it with real genuine passion. It's something that really reaches him emotionally. Try to find the things that animate this man and get him excited, make him laugh. It's just what you do when you approach a character. You try to find out what makes him tick. And that's particularly important if you're playing somebody who people already know is the villain, purely on the basis of what they've seen in the quotes as you walk into the theater.
Yeah.
It's important to upend that because nobody is the villain in his own story.
What do you see as the role of the citizen artist in this moment? That's what you are. You are a citizen artist. What's the
role? Well, you know, Tavis, I did do Beatrice at Dinner. Mm-hmm. I did The Crown, which I think is a wonderful meditation on leadership and mm-hmm. government. But in the middle of all that, I did Trial and Error, Pitch Perfect 3, and Daddy's Home 2. Three pieces of wild nutball entertainment. As I said, I'm a full-service entertainer.
Yes, sir.
My job in life is to delight, excite, sometimes terrify people. Just keep them entertained. It's a wonderful thing when I do something that actually hits the mark, which actually moves the goalpost, moves the chains mm-hmm. down the field in terms of expanding people's consciousness. Mm-hmm. When I did Roberta Muldoon in World According to Garp, when I did Love is Strange with Alfred Molina, when I did M. Butterfly on Broadway. These were all pieces which, in their way, really jostled people's mindset and expanded people's consciousness. It's a wonderful thing when you can do that as an actor. But you can't make it your main mission. Your main mission is simply do your job, delight people, mm-hmm. you know, make them give them emotional exercise, make them cry, make them laugh, and make them scream out in terror. Mm-hmm. those are my jobs. And if possible, make them think, but that's not completely necessary.
Yeah. I take all of that, and yet you will never convince me that you did not take or do not take or will not take a particular delight in this film, given the resonance of it in a time such as this.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad. You know, we made this film in September. By the time we had finished the film, they were just finishing the final cut of the film when the election took place. Suddenly the film was, it suddenly cast a shadow that it didn't have before.
Interested Dinner is the film. If this conversation has encouraged you to see it, then I can't help you, but I highly recommend it.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Syeda Garrett is a Grammy Award-winning and Oscar-nominated songwriter. She also co-wrote one of Michael Jackson's most famous songs, Man in the Mirror. She's out with a new single called Ghetto, and she joins us now to tell us more. Syeda, good to have you.
Thank you.
When I say Man in the Mirror, you think what?
Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
How do you not? I think change. I think a swelling of consciousness, of change. There was change in the air. It was electric.
Yeah.
And he delivered that message with such style and perfection. It touched the world. I mean, he introduced me as a singer, first of all, to the world, and then me as a songwriter with that song, Man in the Mirror.
Tell me about writing this song.
Really, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version.
Yeah, yeah. I
was signed to Quincy Jones as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. And he had a meeting with his songwriters and said, we need one more song to finish out the Bad album. So I took some copious notes and I went to my co-writer friend, Glenn Ballard. And I said to him, Quincy wants a song for this album. He said, great, what kind of song? I don't know. He said, okay, let's just see what we come up with. Cut to 2 years before, I'm at a writing session. And the guy I'm writing with, I thought we were having a great session and the phone rings. And he picks up the phone and begins this very banal conversation. Mm. No, I'm not doing nothing. Nah. And I'm flipping through my lyric book, thinking to myself, no, he didn't just say he's not doing nothing. No, he, I was just seething, flipping through my pages. Then I heard him say, the man? What man? Oh, the man in the mirror. I wrote down Man in the Mirror. 2 years later, I'm at Glenn's house. He says, oh, well, let's just see what we come up with. He gets up to turn on the keyboard, and he starts playing. Doom, 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 doom. Flipping through the book, the phrase popped off. Every time I tell this story, I get goosebumps. The phrase Man in the Mirror popped off the page, and I couldn't write it. I couldn't write the lyrics fast enough. And I think it was like 10 or 12 minutes. We came up with the first verse and the chorus to Man in the Mirror. 2 days later, we demoed it. That night, I took it to Quincy, and he listened to it and called me back a couple hours later and said, Syd, this is the best song I've heard in 10 years. And I'm like, and then he said, but, and then, you know, when Charlie Brown's teacher talks, he doesn't really hear what,
yeah.
That's what I just wanted to live in best song,
right.
10 years, yes.
Right.
And he said, but, you know, we've been in the studio with Michael for 2.5 years and he's yet to record anything that he didn't write. He said, but don't worry. If we don't do it on Michael's album, I do it with James Ingram on my record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love James Ingram as much as the next, okay,
yeah.
but I'm like.
James Ingram, Michael Jackson.
So I just had to let it go, I had to let it go. But a couple of days later, they called me, and Quincy said, and I quote, we in the studio recording your old piece of song. And I'm like, yes! It was like I was on cloud 50-11. You hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
It was awesome.
There are two or three things about that story that are amazing to me. One is, as you well know, as hardcore Michael Jackson fans know and James Ingram fans know, is that James had his own song.
Absolutely.
PYT.
Oh, that's right.
Was Jane
Zingham. That's right. That's
so,
right.
So, you know, Jane Zingham ain't no poo butt. I mean, he's
not by any stretch. Yeah,
Jane's got some great stuff of his own, but he wrote PYT for Michael. So,
that's right.
And I know you and Q are like best of friends, and you went past the story so fast. But when Q tells you that we need one more song for Michael's album, you just told the story like, okay, I went away and got my songwriting book out. Well, first of all,
like, you said we only had 12 minutes.
Yeah.
Huh?
But like when Chrissy tells you we need one more song for Michael Jackson's album, it's like, how do you even calm yourself down to...
Well, I didn't know I was going to get it. Hello?
But still.
But I had to... I don't even know what gave me the audacity to think that I could write anything for Michael Jackson. Because, number one, I'd never met him. Number two, I knew he didn't want to sing like another old baby love song. I knew in order to get his this is where it was.
Right.
I wanted to meet him. And the other guys in my group had already met him. And Quincy said, don't worry, I'll introduce you to Michael. Yeah. And I didn't want it to be Quincy going, Michael, this is Betty, Joe, Saida, Ralph. And, you know, I don't know how that came out of me like that, but I knew I wanted to make him want to meet me. Yeah. Can you imagine that?
Mm-hmm. No, I get it.
I can't imagine it. But I just wanted to write a song that got his attention and felt important enough for him to want to record.
Yeah. When you actually heard Michael singing your stuff, how did you process that?
The only time I really heard it was when it was on the radio.
Right.
But that was, you know, I wasn't in the studio when he recorded the lead vocal, but I was in the studio when I had to re-record the demo.
Right.
And it was the first time I'd met him, and, you know, I'm in the room with Quincy and Bruce Sweetin, engineer of life, mm-hmm. and Michael Jackson, and me. And Quincy said, the key is a little bit too high for Michael. Can you sing it in a lower key? I'm like, sure. So I get up and I go to the studio. Michael Jackson gets up and like is following me it was the 80s, so he had a video camera that was like a mile long right on his shoulder, and he's following me. I'm like, what are you doing? He said, I want to sing it. I said, why are you following me? He said, because I want to sing it like you. I said, great, Mike. All my friends are really going to believe me when I say he wants to sing it like me. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So, tell me about this new song, which
Darling, I've been waiting to tell you.
No, I love it. And the audience is going to love it, too. Tell me about it, though.
It's a song called Ghetto. Ghetto is a state of mind, and it's an acronym for the words greatness happens even though there's oppression. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this song because as I travel and tour around the country doing speaking engagements, and people ask me to tell them my story, I start out by telling them I was, you know, my mom and father divorced when I was 6 years old, and I ended up spending most of my childhood and the happiest times of my childhood with my grandmother on 119th in Wilmington, you know, straight out of Compton, baby. Okay, so they see me say things like where I came from and where I am today, and it's incongruous.
Yeah.
It doesn't mesh for them.
Right.
Like, since I came from that, I'm not supposed to be all this. I'm not supposed to have 2 Oscar nominations. I'm not supposed to have Grammys. No one expected me to be anything.
Yeah.
So, and it's only because I say I grew up I'm from Compton.
Yeah.
And I want the kids who are impoverished, who are living below the poverty line, who are hungry, who are uneducated, not really going to school, because they use their situation, their circumstance, to justify that kind of behavior. I wanted to write a song that said, it doesn't matter where you came from, it's about where you end up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can come from anything. You can come from whatever and be anything. And I want everybody who grew up like me not having to know that that's not your destiny if you don't want it to be. And not having your mother and father, or not having, you know, a job, or going to jail, letting all those negative circumstances dictate your future and what you're going to be. I wrote a song that says that doesn't have to be like that.
And
you get to hear the song.
Ghetto is a state of mind.
There it is. Saeeda Garrett is, I love her and love that voice. And Man in the Mirror, and I Just Can't Stop Loving You. And oh my God, it's just, I'm honored to have you on the program.
Dude, I'm so honored to be here. Thank you so much.
I'm more honored to tell you that in just a second, Saeeda's going to sing Ghetto for you. Here comes Saeeda Garrett.
Matter who you are, only thing that matters is where you end up. Ghetto is a state of mind, ghetto is a place inside. Doesn't matter where you're from, only thing that matters is where you end up. A child is born, tenement slum. He may be poor, but never was dumb. His clothes are warm, shoes and feet shined and clean, but nothing to eat. He grew a man, head held high. He wrote a book and won the Nobel Prize. Where you are does not depend on where you're going or where you've been, cause ghetto is a state of mind. Ghetto is a piece you find. Doesn't matter who you are, only thing that matters is where you end up. Ghetto is a state of mind. Ghetto is a place inside. Doesn't matter where you're from, only thing that matters is where you end up. A baby's born high on the hill with a silver spoon and a free will. Plant the garden, sow the seeds. There'll be flowers, but there will be weeds. He grew a man, head held bent. He broke the law and away he went. Where you are does not depend on where you're going or where you've been, cause Webster's defines the word ghetto as the poorest part of any city in which a particular group lives with limited opportunity. A crowded urban district confined by poverty or prejudice. To me, ghetto stands for greatness happens even though there's oppression. Yes.
Ghetto is a state of mind.
Ooh, ooh.
Ghetto is a place you find.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Doesn't matter who you are.
Don't matter.
Only thing that matters is
only thing that matters.
Ghetto is a state of mind.
Not enough.
Ghetto is a place inside.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.